Hey, John, did the cookies come out of the cafe here also?
Yes. Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you can see me, I'm over here. Welcome to the Watertown Free Public Library. My name is John Horrigan, and the Ancient Order of Hibernians, Division 14, located right across the way here in Watertown, Mr. Leo Falter, president, is celebrating Irish Heritage Month. And Leo asked me to speak on behalf of the Hibernians here this evening, and I'm ecstatic to be here. Tonight's lecture is entitled The Broad Street Riot. It's about a 19th century lecture. Now you see up there on the screen, that's the way Irish were depicted in the early 19th century, as apes. A little background on me, I've been called a historical raconteur. I've been called a lot of things, but I can only say these in public. A historical raconteur, a New England folklorist, and a rogue nostalgian. I'm a member of the Historical Society of Watertown. Thank you very much, Joyce, Kelly, and all the members here from the Historical Society, Peggy, Kay, for being here and for advertising this. Also a member of the Waltham Historical Society, the Society in Dedham for the Apprehension of Horse Thieves, of course, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, Division 14, and I'm a colonial reenactor with the Lincoln Minutemen, and I'm a professional sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni and New England Patriots alumni, and also with the Court Jesters comedy basketball team. And I sponsor the New England History Festival every year held at Hibernian Hall this year, November 13th, a Saturday, 2010, at 5 o'clock, historyfestival.org. Before I go on, I just want to salute the ladies of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. I want to tell you about a Hammerama on March 26th at 7 o'clock, free admission. You can win 160 different chances to win. And also the Craft and Indoor Yard Sale, Saturday, April 10th at Hibernian Hall. So thank you, ladies. A Conan bow. Remember him? We'll explain that later. So some great Irish riots we're going to look at. We're going to look at some great Boston riots, great Harvard riots, early Irish in Boston, the early Boston Fire Department, the Ursuline Convent riot, and then close it out with the Broad Street riot. I'll just briefly mention these riots, but Boston has a history of riots. The Boston Bread Riot of 1713, the Boston Brothel Riot of 1737, the Boston Anti-Impressment Riot of 1747, the Knowles Riot of 1756, the Boston Massacre, of course, 1770, and what followed was the Boston Anti-Loyalist Riot in 1770, the Boston Tea Party of 1773, if you want to call that a riot, Shays Rebellion in Springfield, 1787, more Boston Brothel Riots in 1825, the Charlestown Anti-Catholic Riots, and that leads into our story tonight, the Ursuline Convent Riot, which we'll speak of, in 1834, the Gentleman's Riot of 1835, the Broad Street Riot of 1837, and then the Butman Riot in Worcester, 1854, the Boston Draft Riots, 1863, Civil War Insurrection, Boston Police Strike of 1819. And then, of course, my favorite are the Great Harvard University Rebellions. When things got tense at that quaint little cow school down the river from us here, they tended to throw their food around, but there was an earthquake riot in 1761 where some students ran down the streets yelling earthquake, and when people came to their doors, they got hit with a handful of gravel. The Great Butter Rebellion, Our Butter Doth Stinketh, where they took butter and flipped it into the dean's face, 1766. The Great Harvard Riot of 1788. The Bread and Butter Rebellion of 1805. The Great Rotten Cabbage Rebellion of 1807. The Great Rebellion of 1818. The Great Student Rebellion of 1823. And then the Great Harvard Student Blow-Up, 1834. The O. Reinhardt Riot, that was a signal. They'd say, O. Reinhardt, and that would be a message to students to congregate in Harvard Yard. And then the O. Reinhardt Redux Flash Riot of 1932, the Pogo Riot of 1952, and the Diploma Riots of 1961. So my point is that Boston is not lone to riots. Riots have been happening throughout its entire history. What about the early Irish in Boston? Well, by 1830, about 11% or 7,000 of the city of Boston's 61,000 residents were Catholic. Most Catholics were of German, French, and Irish descent. Boston was expanding and growing in population dramatically. Josiah Quincy, the city's second mayor from 1823 to 1828, made great strides in modernizing the city and expanding its infrastructure. Aside from Irish and German immigrants, rural workers from New England and the Maritimes were pouring into Boston in search of work. Josiah Quincy was sympathetic to the plight of the immigrant and sought to improve their sanitary conditions. He put restrictions on livestock, collected garbage regularly, and cleaned the streets. This also improved the health of the city. So with a rapid growth in population comes increased crime, public drunkenness, arson, prostitution, and vagrancy. Boston has not changed in the last 200 years. Of course, you have the xenophobic Yankee haters, and I'm not talking about the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry. Rioting was like a spectator sport between rival volunteer fire companies and neighborhood gangs in the 19th century. There was a deep-seated hatred of all newcomers. Historian Jack Tager, quote, says, "Hatred against Catholicism by Yankee plebeians was an intrinsic part of their heritage." In the 1830s, the Boston Irish were timid and tried not to draw attention to themselves. Boston was a huge seaport and eventually a melting pot. Irish immigration began in the late 1700s. Many Irish immigrated to Boston during the potato famine that occurred between 1845 and 1852 in Ireland when 1 million died and another million left their homes. This is a fire in the background, circa 1825. So let's just look at a quick history of the Boston Fire Department, 1630 to 1631, depending upon if you're looking at the Julian or Gregorian calendar. The first fire prevention ordinance was that banned thatched roofs and wooden chimneys. In fact, a few years before in Plymouth, smoking was only permitted indoors because embers were getting on the thatched roofs. Come full circle on that. And the first major fire in Boston took place on January 14, 1653. And in March 1st of that year, a contract was made with Joseph Jinks for a water engine to be brought to the fire. Of course, the engine failed in its first major fire. So on January 27, 1678, and this is after a major fire in Boston in 1676 that took the home of Paul Revere's family, the first paid call municipal fire department was organized, and Thomas Atkins is the first fire chief, aided by 12 assistants. The first fire engine is purchased and a building is provided to house the fire engine, and the engine is imported from England. It was lodged in a shed on town land on Queen, which is now Court Street, near the then prison. November 7, 1683, a special general court of Massachusetts passes a law specifying the use of brick or stone for the construction of any structure in the town of Boston. This was passed due to the volume of fires, which had destroyed many wood structures over the years. On January 1st of 1712, Mr. James Pearson is appointed overseer of the water engines, and in February of 1712, the first board of fire wards was established, with a dozen gentlemen being named. February 22nd, 1822, the City Fire Society is founded. And then finally, on June 19th, 1828, to bring us up to this lecture, the Charitable Association of the Boston Fire Department is instituted. Volunteer fire companies are established all over Boston. This basically precedes baseball clubs for all intent and purpose. It was a boys' club, hanging out in the firehouse, waiting to go to a fire. Rum flowed freely, as did the cards. Let's take a look at the Ursuline arson. Now, when I researched this case, I went into the Mass Historical Society. There are wonderful books, and I'll show you one at the end, Fire and Roses. But I decided to take Carmine A. Prioli's The Ursuline Outrage, which was pulled from American Heritage magazine in 1982. And you'll see pictures in the background of the convent, both before and after the fire. So in the shadow of Bunker Hill, bigots perpetrated an atrocity that showed a shocked nation that the fires of the Reformation still burned in the New World. On a sweltering Monday afternoon in July of 1834, Edward Cutter of Charlestown, Massachusetts, was startled by the sudden appearance of a woman in his house. Her hair was closely shorn, she was clad only in a flimsy nightdress, and she was muttering incoherently. Cutter probably surmised that she was from the Ursuline convent a few hundred yards up the hill, then known as Mount Benedict. Sure enough, before long, a carriage was dispatched from the convent, and the deranged woman was quietly escorted back there by the Mother Superior and the Right Reverend Benedict Fenwick, the Bishop of the Boston Diocese. Later, Cutter learned that the woman who had so unexpectedly descended upon him was indeed a nun. In fact, she was Sister Mary John, the mother assistant of the Ursuline community, which operated the Mount Benedict School for Girls. Her bedraggled appearance and nervous disorder were, the Mother Superior later explained, the symptoms of a brain fever brought on by the suffocating heat and the stress of a heavy academic workload. Following her return to the convent, Sister Mary John's condition was reported as significantly improved under the care of the Ursuline sisters. Before long, however, Charlestown bristled with rumors. A girl had tried to escape from the nuns at Mount Benedict, but had been captured and was imprisoned at the Catholic school. Several daily newspapers ran sensational stories about the mysterious lady who was held against her will, maybe tortured, perhaps even murdered by the Catholics. On August 8th, 1834, the Boston Mercantile Journal, under the heading of Mysterious, ran the story of her alleged imprisonment. 3 days later, the same paper published a small retraction. The Bunker Hill Aurora says that the version we lately gave of the mysterious affair at Charlestown is materially incorrect. But it was too late. The flames of bigotry already had been kindled. At the time of the American Revolution, there are only about 100 Catholics in Boston. Predominantly French, Irish, or Spanish, they had no church organization or regular place of worship. Priests were transient, and it wasn't until 1790 that the Superior of Roman Catholic Missions in the United States ordered one of its ablest men, the Reverend John Thayer, a former Congregationalist minister, to strike northward from Baltimore for the hub of the Protestant universe, Boston. Services in Boston for the next decade were held in a rented Huguenot chapel, but it was not long before the Catholics outgrew their humble origins. They were skilled artisans and shrewd businessmen who adjusted well to the Protestant work ethic, and by the turn of the century, they numbered around 1,200 and enjoyed two assets for continued success: influential friends and money. In 1799, they commissioned Charles Bulfinch, fresh from his work as chief architect of the Massachusetts State House, to build their exquisite cathedral. In 1808, even Rome began to take notice, and Pope Pius VII designated Boston an episcopal see. So by 1820, it seemed natural that the Catholic community should have an elegant school for girls. The Ursuline curriculum included basic courses in plain and ornamental writing, arithmetic, geometry, chemistry, and botany, natural and moral philosophy, rhetoric, logic, and the use of the globes were also taught, along with ornamental needlework, japanning, and drawing in all its varieties. And finally, almost as an afterthought, for an additional $20, students could attend to cookery. Established in 1820 on Franklin Street, the first Ursuline school prospered so quickly that in 1826, the Mother Superior, Sister Mary Edmund St. George, moved her community to a larger building in Charlestown at the foot of Plowed Hill, which ironically was directly across from Bunker Hill. The name of the property was changed to Mount Benedict after the presiding bishop, and construction began on the new convent school. The completed building was, for the 1830s, most elaborate. It was a brick structure, 80 feet long and 3 stories high, with wings on either side, an enclosed courtyard, and terraced gardens. Years later, Louise Whitney, a student at Mount Benedict, recalled that nearly the whole of Mount Benedict was enclosed for the use of the convent. There was a lodge, a bishop's house, several terraced walks, and grounds tastefully laid out for the recreation of the pupils. No such elegant and imposing building had ever been erected in New England for the education of girls. Picturesque on the summit of the hill, its many-windowed facade glowing in the light of the setting sun, it was a sightly object to the good citizens of Boston returning from their afternoon drive in the suburbs. Unfortunately, the good citizens of Boston were not the only ones eyeing the new building. Charlestown.
What area of Charlestown?
Directly across from Bunker Hill. The ground would later be leveled, so it's really not a hill. To the Protestant workers toiling throughout greater Boston, the hilltop edifice typified a religion whose presence signaled economic strife. They failed to distinguish between the small, affluent religious community that sponsored the convent and the masses of poor Irish Catholics now settling in Boston, willing to provide the cheap labor that threatened the livelihoods of thousands of Yankee workmen. By the 1830s, scuffles between Protestants and Catholics were commonplace. To make matters worse, the exotic quality of the building and the nuns who moved through it piqued local curiosity. Quote, "The whole establishment," said Louise Whitney, "was as foreign as the soil whereon it stood, as if, like Aladdin's palace, it had been wafted from Europe by the power of a magician." Although the school was run by Roman Catholics, fewer than 10 of the 50 to 60 students enrolled in 1834 were of the Catholic faith. The remaining majority were mostly daughters of upper-class Boston Protestants, cultured and successful parents who wanted more for their young women than the public schools then provided. For the first 150 years of Boston's existence, only boys were permitted to attend public schools. Girls were not admitted until 1790, and then only for 6 months a year. Thus, opposition to the convent school came, in part, from other Boston Protestants, and especially from conservative clergymen like the Reverend Lyman Beecher. He'll show up later. Beecher was convinced that the Romish heretics meant to subvert the United States government and deliver America squarely into the Pope's despotic hands. Diluting the cream of Protestant youth was the first step, and papist propagandists had gotten a foothold in, of all places, Boston, the bulwark of American Puritanism. Pulpits rang with clamorous accusations, and always there were the questions. Why were the Catholics meddling with our children? Why were they not uplifting their own miserable offspring from their own lamentable poverty? The Sisters of the Order of St. Ursula were primarily educators, and their mission in Boston was to provide a superior education for young women, whatever their religious denomination, whose parents could afford it. Few could have foreseen that by 1834, the Catholic population would increase tenfold to more than 20,000 souls. You know, so you're talking just about 60 years ago from the American Revolution, where there were only 100, to 20,000. And most of them were indigent and uneducated, very poor. With their distinguished history of charitable works, it is likely that the Ursulines would have adjusted their mission to meet the growing social need. But they never really had that chance in Boston. The riot that broke out on the night of August 11, 1834, was precipitated by rumors of the mysterious lady, combined with tales of depravity and torture professed by a girl named Rebecca Teresa Reed, who claimed to have escaped from the convent in 1831. The workmen of Charlestown confused the mysterious lady with the young Rebecca, and the story became more fanciful and grotesque with each telling. On Sunday morning, August 10, 1834, placards were found posted in several parts of Boston saying, quote, "To the selectmen of Charlestown, gentlemen, it is currently reported that a mysterious affair has lately happened at the nunnery in Charlestown. Now it is your duty, gentlemen, to have this affair investigated immediately. If not, the truckmen of Boston will demolish the nunnery Thursday night, August 14th. Convinced that trouble was brewing, the selectmen enlisted Edward Cutter. He was the guy who had that nun first show up on his doorstep. And on Monday afternoon, they were permitted to inspect the convent. Their guide was none other than Sister Mary John, the mysterious lady herself, who had now happily recovered from her brain fever, her disorientation. No dungeons, torture chambers, or improprieties of any kind were uncovered, and the selectmen went home to draft a statement assuring an aroused public that nothing unusual was going on at Mount Benedict. This statement was to appear in Tuesday morning's papers and might well have saved the convent, but even as the selectmen wrote, events overwhelmed them. The siege of Mount Benedict began around 8 p.m., some accounts have it beginning at 7:30 p.m., when a mob gathered at the front door of the convent, shouting for the release of the mysterious lady. At least part of the responsibility for what followed must be borne by the Mother Superior, a headstrong woman who did little to conceal her contempt for the workmen. Hadn't the innocent sisters already endured enough slanderous abuse? Hadn't she opened up her doors just a few hours earlier to an inspection committee, and hadn't they left completely satisfied? What would it take to convince these vulgar blockheads that there's nothing here for them? Exclaiming, quote, and this is what egged them on, "The bishop has 20,000 of the vilest Irishmen at his command," she threatened the Protestants with ferocious retaliation. Sister Mary St. George's declaration enraged the mob, whose spirits already had been enlivened with rum. Her threat was answered with two pistol shots, apparently meant as signals to others at milling at the foot of the hill. So this was a setup. Somebody fires two shots into the air, which signals the mob to move on the convent. And then we have a wonderful eyewitness account here. Lucy Thaxter, a student at the school, said, quote, "I could keep still no longer, but getting up, went to a window from which I had a distant view of the convent gate. There, I could see a dense black mass apparently moving up the avenue towards the house, and the sound of their prolonged hurrahs came upon my ears like the yells of thousands of fiends. Soon the noisy crowd swelled as hundreds of spectators joined the corps of rioters. Tar barrels were set ablaze, and that brought firemen from surrounding communities." There were church bells, fire bells ringing everywhere over Boston that day. "But when they arrived on the scene, they did nothing." 2 days later, the Mercantile Journal reported that, quote, "From 150 to 200 men disguised in various fantastic dresses and with painted faces immediately commenced breaking open the doors and windows of the convent. The number of persons assembled as actors in the scene of destruction or spectators has not been has been computed to be in the thousands, but no attempt was made to restrain the mob in their acts of violence. Not a magistrate nor police officer was to be seen. Engines from Charlestown, Boston, and we believe from Cambridge were on the spot, but no effort was made by the firemen to extinguish the fire. As the rioters crashed through the front doors, the nuns and schoolgirls were quietly slipping out into the back garden, where a high wooden fence blocked their escape. They took refuge in front of a mausoleum containing the bodies of several Ursuline nuns. There, the terrified nuns and children hid as the assault on the convent got underway. Once inside, the mob quickly overran the convent from garret to cellar, top to bottom. First, the rioters ransacked the basements, where they hoped to uncover the fabled dungeons and torture chambers. Finding none heightened their anger to frenzy. Huddled in the garden with her schoolmates, Louise Whitney heard their voices sounding like, quote, "the hoarse growling of a pent-up sea." With the mausoleum at their backs, the refugees watched the destruction of their school. The darkened windows came alive with torches. Story by story, fantastic silhouettes ascended, upending furniture, smashing pictures and china, stealing what could be carried. Occasionally, the din would give way to a brief silence. Suddenly, a window would clear, and a large piece of furniture would fill the gap for a minute, and then the crash to the pavement below, followed by cheers and laughter. Despite their terror, none of the girls cried out, even as smoke began to drift from the convent. "We were shut up in that garden," Mrs. Whitney wrote, "as closely as if we were in prison, with no place even of temporary refuge from the rioters but the tomb. And the poor girls held the tomb in as much horror as they did the rioters." Imagine that, being trapped in a room full of coffins. Within minutes, they heard footsteps on the other side of the fence. Beset by new terror, the children rushed toward the Mother Superior, trying to stifle their screams lest they be heard. Suddenly, the footsteps stopped and hands began to tear down the fence. Louise Whitney heard, quote, "the deep breathing of men intent on hard work." It became clear that escape for the girls and the nuns was impossible. Quote, "I looked at the superior anxiously. Brought to bay at last, she opened her mouth to call out, 'Who is there?' I hastily interrupted her, not knowing what might happen if her voice was heard, and taking the word from her lips, with a desperate effort of courage, I confessed that I called out, 'Who is there? What do you want?' A horrible moment of silence, and then a suppressed voice answered. We are friends. Don't be afraid. We've come to save you. The superior knew the voice and exclaimed joyfully, It is Mr. Cutter, and his men are with him. Oh, God be thanked, she added fervently. As the nuns and schoolgirls were spirited away, the carnage continued. While flames roared through the convent, rioters looted and fired surrounding buildings, including the bishop's house and library. Then they broke into the mausoleum, opened the coffins, and mutilated the remains of the dead. When the news of the convent's destruction became known, everyone expected reprisals by bands of enraged Irishmen. Even Bishop Fenwick feared the worst, and in a letter to his brother he confided, Certainly some lives will be lost in case of another attack, for our good Irishmen are now wound up to a point where if you go one step further, the cord will snap. But the reprisals never came. How Irish Catholic emotions were kept in check is still a mystery to this day. The bishop's pleas for restraint alone could not have been enough in light of the continued Protestant outrages. On August 12th, the next night, the night after the Mount Benedict riot, another mob marched through Boston intent upon burning the Catholic cathedral. When confronted with armed guards, the mob returned to Mount Benedict, where they proceeded to finish the work that they had begun the night before, setting shrubs, vines, fruit trees, and fences ablaze. The rampage was resumed yet a third time on Wednesday night, August 14th, with another attempt to pull down the cathedral. Again, confronted with armed guards, the mob set out for Charlestown and was detained only when the Boston drawbridge was raised against it. Not all responses to the burning, however, were anti-Catholic. Loud expressions of outrage and disgust came from Protestant circles. Even Lyman Beecher, who the night before the riot squeezed in three anti-Catholic sermons, denounced the mob action from his pulpit the following Sunday, while another clergyman put it to his congregation this way. Do you wish to introduce a Protestant Inquisition to establish a religion by law, crush all dissenters from the legal faith, and bring back the age of persecution for opinion? An investigative committee made up of respected citizens, among them Harrison Gray Otis, later U.S. Senator and Mayor of Boston, subsequently vindicated the Ursulines of the alleged wrongdoings and provided evidence leading to the arrest of 13 men. Their trials began in December of 1834 and lasted nearly 6 months. The first and most sensational was that of the ringleader, John R. Buzzell, a brawny 6'6" brickmaker with a reputation for street fighting. Over the objections of Attorney General James T. Austin, who claimed that prosecution witnesses were being threatened with death, Buzzell's trial began on December 2nd. Buzzell's gang, they found out, had stormed in at 11:30 p.m., ransacked the convent, including every desk and cupboard, laughing and swearing all the way. They flung communion wafers around, some dancing in the nuns' robes, and by 12:30 a.m., flames erupted from every corner of the convent. They pried off the nameplates from coffins, they bashed open the caskets, and emptied the remains on the floor of the mausoleum. Buzzell then urinated on these carcasses. Only Marvin Massey was found guilty, and he served less than 1 year in prison. The rest, Buzzell and his 11 cohorts, would walk free. Two indictments were brought against him. This is Marvin Massey. One for arson, one for burglary. This is for Buzzell. Two indictments, one for arson, one for burglary, and they were both hanging offenses in the year 1834. But to most observers, Buzzell's acquittal was a foregone conclusion, even though his guilt was never in doubt. One illustrated account published in Boston within days after the trial refers in its title to Buzzell as the leader of the rioters, even though this account concludes with the jury's verdict of innocence. The decision, we are told, was received with thunders of applause by the audience, while outside the courthouse, Buzzell received the congratulations of thousands of his overjoyed fellow citizens. As each of the accused came before the judges and was acquitted, the Catholics realized how hopeless their cause had become. Although the evidence against the 13 defendants was overwhelming, all but one went free. As I mentioned, Marvin Massey, a footloose 16-year-old, was convicted for his mock auction and burning of the bishop's books. He was sentenced to life imprisonment at hard labor, but at the request of 5,000 citizens, including Bishop Fenwick, whose name headed the list, and the Mother Superior, Massey, was pardoned. The triumphant Buzzell was doubtless less delighted by an unexpected outcome to the burning. It bolstered the Catholic cause as few other events could have. One unidentified Protestant writer who remained staunchly anti-Catholic deplored the burning for its obvious cowardliness, but more because it rallied popular sympathy where none should have been afforded. The propaganda of Rome, he fumed in 1835, and the founders of the Leopold Fund in Austria to convert heretics in America could not have found better missionaries for their purpose than the scoundrels who burnt the convent. No compensation was ever given for the destruction of Ursuline Convent. The convent ruins stood for nearly half a century, grim evidence that Reformation fires of intolerance still smoldered more than 200 years after they were brought to America. The hill upon which the Ursuline Convent stood is now part of Somerville. By the turn of the century, Mount Benedict had been leveled. Its soil was used for landfill. Nothing remains of the convent except some bricks which form the arch of the front vestibule of the present Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston. Attorney General Austin was prescient enough to see this bleak irony taking shape, and in his closing statements at Buzzell's trial, he asked the jury, "Where will be the pride of your American feelings when you take the stranger to Bunker's Heights and show him the slowly rising monument? Where will be the pride of your American feelings when that stranger points to the other monument of ruins that frowns so gloomily on the adjacent eminence? The chills of 50 winters would not send such an ice bolt through your hearts." And finally, the ciborium from Mount Benedict that was thrown away that night by Henry Creasy was eventually recovered. Creasy, one of Buzzell's boys, would later commit suicide. And again, I recommend this book, Fire and Roses, by Nancy Lusignan Schultz. Any questions before I move to Broad Street? So now we move on to the Broad Street Riot. And I extracted this from Peter F. Stevens' The Hidden History of the Boston Irish. Once again, thank you to the Watertown Free Public Library for supplying me with all my resources, as usual. The Minuteman Library Network is excellent. This is a depiction. You're going to see this in the background. But if you look at Great Financial Crisis, I do another talk called Panics, Booms, Busts, Bubbles, Recessions, and Depressions, a History of American Financial Crises. From the Mississippi land bubble of 1720, Dewar's Last Panic, 1792, the Depression of 1807, the Depression of 1818, the Depression of 1825, the Depression of 1837, the Depression of 1848, the Depression of 1857, the Depression of 1869, and Grant's Last Panic of 1884. You get the picture. Depressions come every 10, 15 years. We've been through this before. I call this period that we're in the Great Humbling, some last longer. You have to have the nadir, you have to have the low point, the trough, before you zoom out of it. But in 1837, there was a depression in the United States. And this is the Broad Street Riot. It was a warm and sultry June afternoon when Fire Engine Company 20 had returned to its station on East Street in Boston after having quelled a blaze in Roxbury. Some of the firemen went to a nearby saloon on their way back to their homes. They waded into about 100 Irishmen who were on their way to join a funeral procession that was around the corner on C Street. The Boston firefighters, protagonists in this brawl, were native Yankee stock from the poorer streets of Boston, where hostility towards Catholics and the Irish was at its fiercest. It was less than 3 years since the burning of the convent in Charlestown, and also employment was scarce due to the Great Depression of 1837. Tensions ran high. Also, several of the firemen moving towards the crowd of Irishmen allegedly had their hand in the Ursuline Convent fire. They exchanged surly stares, and it seemed peaceable enough as it looked as though the firefighters would pass through the crowd without incident. One engine man, 19-year-old George Fay, had lingered longer than his comrades over his cups. He had a lot of the creature in him, liquid courage. This is a depiction of immigrants, by the way. So Fay, with a cigar dangling from his lips, he shoved several of the Irishmen and insulted them. Fay then flailed away at the Irish in his vicinity, throwing punches. His comrades jumped in to help him out, but they were badly outnumbered and two were severely beaten. The engine men then fled to their station at the order of third foreman W.W. Miller. Here's the culprit, this guy. If Miller had simply barred the door, the pursuing Irish probably, and I want to stress, probably would have turned back to their funeral procession if he had just locked the door. But Miller, quote, lost his head completely, carried away either with fear or with rage and a thirst for revenge. He issued an emergency alarm so that every fire company in Boston would respond to E Street to take vengeance on the Irish. He rings the fire alarm. All around, alarm. He's asking for help. And now all these firefighters are coming in thinking there's a major fire. The Irish began to disperse, but that did not prevent the men of Engine Company 20 from rolling its wagon onto Broad Street and sounding a false alarm. Then Miller dispatched some men to ring the bell at the New South Church and a church on Purchase Street. One of the firefighters dashed to the Engine Company 8 on Common Street yelling, "The Irish have risen up upon us and they're going to kill us." The Irishmen who had fought with Company 20 were now trailing the funeral procession, a hearse and several carriages, trailed by about 500 mourners. The cortege wound its way south onto C Street, winding towards the Bunker Hill Cemetery in Charlestown. Isn't it ironic that it's right near the convent, the Irish section? Engine Company 20 had Miller leading them in pursuit of the Irish, and he shouted, "Let the paddies go ahead, and then we'll start." The firemen rushed towards C Street, yelling, "Now look out, now look for it." The mourners moved only another block when Engine Company 14 fell upon them, and with one fireman, he was heard to cry out, "Down with them!" The procession then turned onto New Broad Street, that's a funeral procession, near today's South Station, and directly into oncoming Engine Company number 9. So they're surrounded by Engine Company 9, 14, and 20 at this point. The horse-drawn fire wagon then veered into the mourners' ranks, scattering and knocking down men, women, and children. The Irish jumped at the conclusion that the number 9's men had intentionally insulted and assaulted them. A melee then erupted, with Miller, Fay, and the rest of Company 20 arriving to join the fracas. Fists and kicks flew in all directions, and screams of rage and pain pealed along Broad Street. By the way, this background you're going to be seeing, that's the only known lithograph or depiction of the Broad Street riot that was drawn up 2 days after the event. And it shows the militia firing on the crowd. We'll get to that in just a moment. As I mentioned, fists and kicks flew in all directions and screams of rage and pain pealed along Broad Street. Sticks, cudgels, and knives soon materialized, and stones, bricks, and other missiles that came to hand slammed against heads and hearse alike. The engine men and the Irishmen would give starkly different accounts of who started the brawl. The Yankees' version was that number 9's engine did not hurt anyone and that the collision was accidental. As one historian points out, the Yankee version did not escape charges of whitewashing. The Irish following the hearse, as well as other witnesses, claim that George Fay, quote, the very head and leader of the quarrel, seized the rope and guided the engine in among the marchers, while some of the firemen tried to kick Irishmen and some cried, "Down with them, trip up the hearse's horse." Then the brawl swelled into a full-scale riot. The hearse's driver inched their way up Broad Street and eventually reached Charlestown, but the procession was quite broken up. Irish women and others from the shattered funeral march ran to Broad Street, which is the Irish section, shrieking for help and added fear-embellished claims that the firemen were killing the Irish and the Yankees had toppled the hearse, smashed open the coffin,
pitched the corpse into the street and desecrated it.
From all corners of the neighborhoods, stretching along the waterfront, Irishmen rushed to the fight. Additional fire companies also poured onto Broad Street, where groaning and unconscious men lay crumpled atop the paving stones. Crowds of spectators, Irish and Yankee alike, now clotted the street, curiously cheering on their respective sides and combatants, quote, exciting the brawlers almost to a point of frenzy. The weight of numbers now lay with the firemen, as their numbers were swelled and their ranks buttressed by Protestant workmen, and they drove the Irishmen all the way down to the entrance of Old Broad Street, a gateway to the Irish neighborhoods. Realizing that they were now fighting for their very homes, immigrant men, women, and children tore bricks and stones from their own hearths to hurl at their foes. As the engine companies and their workmen allies scattered Irishmen and surged into the narrow streets, they chased or dragged Irish families from their homes and plunged into an orgy of looting. Historian Edward Harrington writes, quote, wherever the marauders broke in, they smashed windows and doors, stole whatever they coveted, and then proceeded with savage thoroughness to destroy everything else. Clothing was torn to shreds, shoes were cut to pieces, furniture and household goods of all kinds were thrown into the streets. Feather beds were ripped up and their contents scattered to the winds in such quantities that for a while Broad Street seemed to be having a snowstorm. The pavement, in spots, was buried ankle-deep in feathers. For immigrants who had been rousted from their cottages in Ireland and had seen their homes tumbled by landlords and British troops, the scene was sickeningly familiar. The looters then trashed scores of Irish households. There is evidence that few firemen, despite their brawling with the Irish that day, actually plundered homes. The blame for the break-ins falls largely upon, quote, stout Yankee loafers and young hooligans who trailed the engine companies, urged them on without joining the fight, and seized the chance to plunder. Although continuing the fight, the Irish fell farther back from the overwhelming Yankee gangs. By 6 o'clock, crowds of terrified immigrants crowded the wharves, their backs literally to the water's edge. Help then came belatedly from a source on which few of the Irish would have counted on. Mayor Samuel A. Elliott sent 10 companies of infantry and the Boston Lancers, cavalry, on a sweep along Broad Street in the adjacent Irish neighborhoods. At 7 p.m., the fire companies and their cohorts scattered. That's a picture of Broad Street. After nearly 3 hours of the fury, the Broad Street riot had finally come to an end. Although heads had been cracked and blades and clubs had torn men open, miraculously, nobody had been killed. The number of wounded was so large that it could not be tallied accurately. Again, you have over 1,000 people participating in this. On June 15th, 1837, 17 people were forced to pay reparations of $300 and to attend the nearest term at the municipal court. Mark Adams was held to bail as witnesses reported him for breaking into homes. In July of 1837, 14 Irishmen and 4 Protestant men arrested during the brawl stood trial in front of a jury entirely composed of Yankees. 3 of the Irish were sentenced to several months in jail. All 4 Protestants were found innocent. Only 3 of the Irish men, John Whaley, John Welsh, and Barney Fanning, were assigned hard labor in the House of Correction. John Whaley was sentenced 4 months, while John Welsh and Barney Fanning were sentenced 2 months. The following is quoted from the 1838 Boston Almanac about the event. Broad Street, Boston. On June 11, 1837, a great riot occurred in Broad Street. It commenced between an engine company returning from a fire and an Irish funeral procession. It has not been satisfactorily ascertained which party were the aggressors. The tumult increased to such a degree that nearly 1,000 persons at one time were supposed to be engaged in a brawl, the most desperate that ever occurred in the city. Several houses were broken into, furniture shattered inside, and cast into the street. Beds were ripped open and their contents given to the winds. Sticks, stones, bricks, and all manner of missiles were discharged by the combatants at each other with the utmost ferocity, and yet, strange to tell, no one was killed in the affair. The military was called out and in a strong body marched to the scene of the action, and in a short time the rioters were dispensed or captured. Crowds were sent off to the police court, and at length, after the proper authorities had sifted the whole affair, it resulted in the sending of John Whaley for 4 months, John Welsh and Barney Fanning each for 2 months at hard labor in the House of Correction. On June 15, 1837, 17 persons concerned in the Broad Street riot were ordered to recognize the sum of $300 and to appear at the next term of the municipal court. One American was held to bail, Mark Adams, a truckman, against whom the witnesses testified they saw him aiding in the sacking of houses. And then this shows up in the Boston Gazette, where another riot a week later almost erupts. This is when firemen are coming back and they're hissed at by the Irish. June 18, 1837. The city was very quiet last Monday morning. A military force was stationed at Faneuil Hall today, Sunday, to protect the armories, etc., and to act in case any disturbance should take place. Many Irishmen flock in from Lowell and other places. Their motives are unknown. As the engines were returning from a fire in South Boston, some of the companies were assailed by hissing, hooting, etc. Many attempts were made during the day to kick up a row or a brawl. And then finally, I'm going to close this out here with the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. A rock band did a song about the Broad Street Riot. Just some lyrics here. I'll play it. Let me just play it here. You know, the Dropkick Murphys are known for bringing Irish music to bear. But basically, this is a story. It's about the Broad Street Riot, and the Mighty Mighty Bosstones wrote a song, and that's the picture of them. So the Irish irony, the Boston Irish would go down and go on to dominate politics, property ownership, construction, retail establishments, pubs, the Boston police and fire departments throughout the 20th century in Boston. Thanks for attending. It was a riot being here tonight. Any questions, comments? Does anybody want to throw something at the stage? I'll duck. No, riots, every immigrant population that comes to the New World seems to have its oppression. And it was the Irish and the Catholics, then it was the Italians, then it was the Jews, and then after that it was the current oppression against South American people just because they're illegal. But we have to remember, and I'm not getting on either side of being Democrat or Republican, but my ancestors came over to America and were given the chance to become an American citizen. And I think that as American citizens, I have to offer and extend that same courtesy to those that are in this country illegally, that to give them an opportunity to become an American citizen. I'm off my pulpit. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, it was very loud with that rock and roll music. What was that again?
Why do you take so long for them to call out the police or the militia or something?
Well, it's most of the people in the police and the militia were part of the mob or had relatives in the mob. And I think that they were looking out for their own well-being as well. They couldn't cross the picket line, so to speak, cross the mob line. It was deliberate. It was a setup. I think everybody knew that it was going to happen, and they... You know, I'm sure the police and fire departments said, you know, spread out and give them room to turn. Yes?
Were there similar type riots in
There was a lot of anti-Catholic and anti-Irish and anti-Italian sentiment throughout those communities. But in terms of a brutal 1,000-person melee, that's a rarity when you have people going out. I can tell you that there was a draft riot in 1863 where for $300 you could buy yourself out of the impressment, out of the draft, and the Irish rebelled because they were all poor and they didn't have it. And this is the second wave of Irish that had come over. This is the post-famine, the post-Great Hunger wave, and Italians and Irishmen, and free slaves, for that matter, rebelled against it.
Civil War riots, they weren't just limited to Boston.
New York had them, Philadelphia had them, right, up and down the East Coast, absolutely. And I must tell you that there were Irish riots in New York City, for sure. 1844 comes to mind, and there were riots out in the western part of Massachusetts and Worcester, but yeah, they weren't limited, you're right, not just to Boston, but it was up and down the eastern seaboard, and that's what a mob does. I mean, Russia as a country, as is France, built on rioting and built on overthrows, and there were salt riots in Russia. People usually riot over food, or they riot over injustice, or they riot, as we've seen in the late 20th century, over racial discrimination, where one of their own is brutalized by the police and justice is not carried out. And I think that's when a populace rises up. And I don't think we've seen the last of riots in America, I'll tell you right now. I think that we're heading towards a dangerous period in our American history. And it's basically social class chasms that perhaps can't be bridged, as you have the wealthy elite, the poor, and then what's left of the middle class who's left to help out the poor while the elite, you know, go on to Dubai and hide out their millions. We're in a dangerous age right now where lying is permitted, where stealing is permitted, and we're in this tremendous age of arrogance where we think that we're superior to everybody else. And unfortunately, like Rome, like Greece, like the British Empire, the American Empire will one day, it'll end. And there's no way to prevent that. That's history. And I think that we have to look back in history to find out where is this country going, and that we have to take care of our own plot of land here and not try to put out fires in the Middle East. For God's sakes, get off the Korean Peninsula. Why are you protecting that toxic dump that people call Taiwan that took all the manufacturing jobs from America? I'm on the pulpit. Stop. But you're going to see another upheaval, social upheaval. And I think that the people, there's only so much that they can do in the ballot box. You saw it here in Massachusetts, for instance, where one candidate had the race locked up, and then another candidate, I guess, who posed as a certain type of party, won the election because people came in and rallied and made sure that he won the election. So it's going to be some interesting times ahead. And I just hope that that this country can get back to its basics and get back to people helping people, being honest, working from the heart and not from the wallet. Because some people say about democracy that in the end, the honor system doesn't work. Others say that after communism comes capitalism via socialism. And others say after capitalism comes communism via socialism. And that's frightening. Thanks.
Thank you.